Ali Kasser Jane Show Talk Radio for Fine Minds airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HaliKasserJane.com. Thank you so much for being here. I am Ali Kasser Jane. Today on the Ali Kasser Jane Show, someone whose name you might not recognize, but whose voice will be familiar, and whose face you've seen a million times on both the large and small screen. Joining me at my table is character actor, podcaster, author, writer, director, producer, Stephen Tobolowsky. But before we begin, a brief message from our sponsors. You are listening to the Ali Kasser Jane Show. The Ali Kasser Jane Show is always available online at HaliKasserJane.com and a host of venues, including Blog Talk Radio and iHeart Radio. Today, the Ali Kasser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/The Ali Kasser Jane Show. If you ran into Stephen Tobolowsky on the street, you might say to yourself, haven't we met before? Did we date? Play in the sandbox together as kids? Were we once married? Ha! Well, you probably have seen him before, because character actor Stephen Tobolowsky is everywhere, having appeared in productions that range from Deadwood to Glee, to The Goldbergs, from Mississippi Burning to Groundhog Day, in the part of the annoying but endearing insurance salesman Ned Ryerson, annoying his stock in trade. And still, Tobolowsky is so much more. As a dazzling storyteller and writer, he has earned a devoted fan base for his original stories recorded in the popular podcast, The Tobolowsky Files. And he is the author of The Dangerous Anima Club, billed as a creative mitzvah, a work of art, and a narrative feat that combines biography and essay. But that's not all. In March, he'll be part of the hilarious ensemble cast in Comedy Central's new series, Big Time in Hollywood, Florida, executive produced by Ben Stiller. Let's talk.
Okay, Mr. Stephen Tobolowsky. Talk to me. I'm asking too. You. What's the deal with that name? I love the name.
Are we on the air?
We're on the air.
Oh, well, this is that good of a story, because I had no idea how to pronounce my name either, because different people in my family pronounce it different ways. Tobolowsky, Tobolowsky, Tobolowsky. Tobolowsky. So I asked the pretty much our historian of the family, Uncle Nathan, about 10 years ago. So this means I'm in my 50s. I asked Uncle Nathan how we pronounce our name, Tobolowsky, whatever. And he says you can pronounce it any way you want because it's not really your name.
What?
Yeah. Hello. So, you know, I have this small seizure and I say, excuse me, please, what? Explain. And he says, well, when grandfather came to America, he did not go to Ellis Island. He embarcated in Galveston, Texas. And when he got off of the boat, they asked him, who are you? And grandfather, who didn't speak English, only kind of spoke Yiddish and Hebrew and some German, thought the who, and Russian and Polish, of course, thought the who, wo, is where in German. So he thought that the man asked him, where are you from? And he answered, Abram from Tobolsk, in a kind of Russian-Hebrew sort of way, which the guy in Texas didn't understand. So he did stamp, and he named him Abram Tobolowsky. So, Hallie, that means I got my name the same way Don Corleone got his name in The Godfather. Yeah.
That's how I got mine. So, well, us Jews, you know, it's kind of a weird deal there. So listen to me, buddy. You act, you write, you talk, and you talk well. You direct, you produce, and do you ever sleep? I mean, what's the deal with you, buddy? I mean, you're everywhere. You have to not sleep.
I'm having trouble with the sleeping lately. I reached, now, some people in your audience may be aware of this, but there's an age you get to, like sometime in the 50s, in which martinis don't put you to sleep anymore. They wake you up, and coffee puts you to sleep. You kind of go on this reverse cycle. So I have to be very careful now in the evenings not to have anything like wine or anything that normally would put you to sleep that stimulates you. I look forward to my sleep because I dream and have a very active dream life, and I've always been able to remember major dreams in my life. So this is an important part. Being unconscious is very important to me. Very important.
The favorite part of the night or the day, yeah. Right? There you go. So listen, this is also interesting. First of all, you do not sound like you're from Texas. That is the weirdest Texas accent I've ever heard. And you are from Texas, right?
I am from Dallas, Texas, but my mother was from Pennsylvania, Troop, Pennsylvania, which is right near Wilkes-Barre.
That's where you got that. Yeah, I hear the O in your voice. Yeah, I couldn't figure that out.
Yeah, so that's from Pennsylvania. So I do have a kind of not very good Texas accent.
So anyway, what are your parents like? Were they good parents?
Certainly I think they were wonderful parents. I was lucky I had the parents I had. My mother is no longer with us. She was the spiritual center of the family, the philosopher in chief of our family. My father was gone working all the time. He was a family doctor, always working. But it was my father who, in a way, taught me the alphabet. When I was a little boy, he gave me little blackboard, and we'll keep the parallelism going, and a little piece of chalk. And every day before Dad went to work, he would put a letter of the alphabet on that board. And it was my job to come up with 5 words that day that started with that letter. And my mother, I would go on chores with Mom during the day, and we would look for my words. And I remember being very, very excited. The very first day we did this teaching method, the first letter being A, and Dad told me that day I only needed to come up with 4 words because A itself was a word. And I thought, how good is life going to be? I mean, it's so easy. Yeah. Just the letters themselves are words. So Mom and I had a wonderful time growing up. Primary teacher was Mom.
So it was a good childhood.
I think good childhood. I grew up in the country. Recently, my father is now, bless his heart, 92. Mm. And he apologized for not being able to buy us toys and things when we were little. And I had no idea. We were deprived. We grew up in the woods in the creek, and it was always something wonderful and horrible going on at the creek. There were snakes and spiders and all sorts of fantastic things, poisonous plants. It was a wonderland, and I spent all day in the woods, and you can't get, you know, I don't want to be like every grown-up that always looks back at this generation and says, oh my gosh, these poor kids. But when I grew up, I had a lot of nature around me, and I just don't know if kids have that kind of nature around them anymore, because it is fulfilling to be in that kind of active silence. There is something about it that's so stimulating to the imagination.
I get that. And kids don't go out today. That's really a weird thing about kids today.
No.
That's a really sad thing. So listen to me. You're really good at playing annoying characters. We're going to talk about that later. But before we get to that, were you the annoying kid on the school playground?
I think I was.
Oh, God.
But I was a great student in first grade and a great student in kindergarten, because all I wanted to do, like a lot of little kids, was to go to school, because it meant I was going to be a grown-up. But I ran into that roadblock in second grade. And it was the first time we had long-term assignments. And the teacher had 10 books that we had to read outside of class. And the first book was something called Bucky Beaver Goes to New York. And this was the longest book I had ever seen in my young life. This book was like 240 pages, something like this. Well, I missed the part where the teacher said we could read at our own pace.
Oh, no.
And I thought the book had to be read the next day after she gave everybody a copy of the book. And so I broke into a flop sweat, and I went home and I asked my brother if such a thing were possible. And he said, well, he heard in college people had to work really hard and read all the time. So I started reading Bucky Beaver, and I read Bucky Beaver all day, and I read Bucky Beaver all night, and I read Bucky Beaver in the morning. I developed new speed reading techniques to read with greater number of pages, less comprehension. But I finally got to that magical the end before I got to school the next day. And I had never worked so hard in my life. We got to class, and the teacher said, how many of you read any of your Bucky Beaver? And of course, everybody raised their hand. And she said, how many of you read chapter 1? Everybody raised their hand. And right then I was thinking, like, well, yeah, well, if you read the whole book, of course you read chapter 1. Then she said, how many of you read chapter 2? And about half the class raised their hand. And that was when I was getting the idea that I had misinterpreted the assignment. How many of you read chapter 3? By the time it got to how many of you read chapter 4, there are only like 3 or 4 of us raising their hand. And she went around the room and said, Claire, how many chapters did you read? And Claire said, well, I read 4 and I began chapter 5. Then she said, Stephen, how many chapters did you read? And I was so proud. And I was ready for the praise that I was so worthy of. And I said, I read the whole book. And the entire class broke out in enormous laugh. And the teacher's face turned to this scowl. And she said, how dare you lie to this class? And I was going, what? What? And she said, I want you to stand up right now and apologize to this class for being a clown and carrying on like this. I said, but I did read the whole book. She made me come up to class and she said, tell them, tell everybody you lied. And I said, but I didn't. She said, go out into the hallway. And I stood in the hallway trembling. And the teacher came out to me and she said, Stephen, I will not have liars in my class and I will not have children acting out like this. Now you look me in the eye and you tell me, how much did you read? And I was trembling. And I said, I read the first chapter.
Oh.
And she said, you stand out here for the rest of the period. And she says, I want you to take that book home, and I don't want you to turn that book in until you finish reading it. Well, I now had another problem that I didn't encounter. Now I had to come up with a whole new lie as to when I actually finished the book. And a funny thing happened was that after 2 weeks, I thought, well, maybe that wasn't enough time for Bucky Beaver to get to New York. So I didn't turn the book in. And then was 4 weeks, and I didn't turn it in. Finally, after about 6 weeks, I turned the book in. And she gave me the second book, which I did not read. And I did not read any other book in that class, nor did I read books in 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th grade. And from that point on, I was the class clown, but was no longer the good student. In fact, I didn't start really reading again till college. And that's where I learned the lesson that teachers make a difference.
Oh, yeah.
Make a big difference. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, now what do you want me to do with that? You've got me completely entrenched in that story. My heart is pounding. My eyes are tearing.
It's terrible. What?
And you want me to go on and talk to you for the rest of the hour?
Listen, you know, my adult brain, you know, I look back at that Bucky Beaver event all the time, and I ask myself, you know, had I been in her place, there's so many things I could have done instead. Like I could have said, name 5 things that happen in the last chapter of Bucky Beaver Goes to New York. Who is Bucky Beaver's friend when he gets off the train to New York? All these questions I could have asked had I read the book. So I assumed that my teacher had to use the kind of atom bomb on me because she hadn't read the book herself.
Can we name that teacher? Is she still alive?
She's no longer with us. The teacher who did this was Mrs. Cooper. And a friend of mine from that class has grown up to be a philosopher. Now, how many people you know that grew up to be a philosopher? And she got her degree from Oxford and Harvard. And I told her the story of Bucky Beaver in New York when we had breakfast at the Carlyle not long ago in New York. And she said, Mrs. Cooper, Mrs. Cooper, don't get me started on Mrs. Cooper. So Sally Naomi Jones was how I knew her then. She has a new name now. But Sally Naomi Jones, she had a run-in with Mrs. Cooper too. But, you know, you win some and you lose some when,
listen,
when you're in education.
You came out all right.
I came out all right.
You damn well came. And it may be because you were into Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier.
I was into Davy Crockett. Now that was another terrible story. Because I love Davy Crockett. I thought there was nothing better than Davy Crockett. And I was over the moon when I heard that Disney had done a movie, a movie at the movie theater about Davy Crockett, Davy Crockett at the Alamo. And I thought, this is going to be the bestest movie in the world. And I showed up in Dallas that cold, cold, cold morning wearing my Davy Crockett hat with about 400 other little kids wearing Davy Crockett hats. It was like, we went into that movie theater and walked into an airplane propeller. We had no idea what the Alamo was. We had no idea what was going to happen. And we watched Davy Crockett, Jim Bowie, William Travis gets slaughtered before our very eyes at the Alamo when when did that movie come out? Like 54, 55? You know, I was like 4 or 5 years old, and that's when I had all my dreams dashed.
Your dad gave you your coonskin cap. Do you still have it?
No.
Oh,
no.
Gosh.
I don't know where that went, but I do have another one.
You do?
I do.
So listen, you went to college and you were going to be a geologist?
Yes, I thought that was going to be a viable career path.
So instead you wind up Hollywood. What was it? The roar of the Hollywood freeway? The smell of the celluloid? What the hell got you to Hollywood? I mean, where did that all come from, the acting?
I always wanted to be an actor. When I was little, I wanted to be an actor because I thought it meant that there was a kind of proximity to monsters. I was right, but I had no idea what I was talking about then.
Yeah, really.
But I thought monsters were real. I loved the Wolfman. I loved Godzilla. I loved Frankenstein. And I thought if I were an actor, I could be on the set and actually make friends with these monsters. So I acted in plays when I was little. When I got to college, that whole scenario changed, and I no longer wanted to act with monsters. I was touched by Shakespeare for the first time, and I thought that there was something beautiful and noble in acting. And I read the plays of Chekhov and Ibsen and Shaw, and I thought, I want to be a part of this because this is beauty and this is greatness. And so I love geology and I love rock. So I told my parents that I was studying to be a geologist, which I was. I took classes in geology, but those classes also fit for being a theater major. You had to take a science to be a theater major. So I was all the time a stealth theater major, and I had no idea that when I was studying for the noble profession of being an actor, that it meant I would be on Californication. I would be playing Buck Crack Plumber on, you know, movie. You know, I had no idea really what it meant to be a professional actor. And, you know,
so you didn't think it was going to turn out quite the way that it did. But, you know,
no.
I love this because I'm going to call you Zelig, because your life is so incredibly interesting, and you show up at the right places at the right time with the right people, and we're going to like explore that a little bit in this thing. But I have to say, the kind of actor that you wound up being, did you think that that was going to happen? You know, you're a handsome guy. You're 6 feet two tall?
Yeah, 6'3", and back when I was in my 20s, I actually was somewhat of a looker.
Yeah. You know?
And then in graduate school, my hair fell out, like, in one day. You know, when little kids play softball, always the best athlete plays the pitcher. The best hitter on the team is always the pitcher. And then you grow up and the pitcher's always the worst. When you're in school and in college, they often give the actors with the most panache or skill playing the old characters, the old people. And they give, like, the other people the ingenue. So when I was 24, I was playing an 86-year-old man in this play and spraying my hair with streaks and tips for a couple of weeks. And when that show finished, I jumped in the shower and my hair came out in clumps. I was like, you know, Karen Silkwood in the shower. It was like balls of hair just falling out of my head. And I looked in the mirror and it was one of the most devastating days of my life because I could kind of see I had lost my hairline. I could see clumps of scalp underneath. And it was that day I realized I would never play Hamlet. I would never be a leading man again. I had no idea it meant what I would be doing, but I knew that everything I dreamt of doing was done. In one shower, it was done. And I had to kind of rethink what I was going to do at that point in time.
So did you have somebody in mind when you formed this career? Did you, when you realized it was character actor, which I think has always been the strongest, truly part of any film. I mean, it's the anchor of a film for all the pretty boys and pretty ladies that are out there. When you think about it, you establish a position in a film that is just extraordinary. Did you think about that? And do you have a character actor that you went, oh, I want to have a career like that?
Not really. When I came out to Los Angeles, there were still a lot of the great old character actors walking around. You know, from all the old
westerns,
Warner Brothers.
Yeah,
yeah. And I would ask them, you know, like Ward Bond and Frank Finlay. You know, I would say, tell me about what it was like, and I would ask them these kind of questions. But I just loved great performances.
Yeah.
So I glommed onto the performances of Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart and Humphrey Bogart. last night they had Casablanca on.
Oh, yeah, right.
And there isn't a bad performance in that movie. And in a way, it was glomming on to the actors that were the storytellers that made me think, I want to be a part of telling a good story. And so that way, it didn't matter to me if I had a big part or a small part. I could do whatever part I had the best that I could do and be a part of a great story. Now, the problem, of course, in Hollywood is that there aren't that many good stories either.
Well, not lately.
No, no. you know, there's a handful of them because the story isn't the thing anymore.
Right.
Now it's the franchise. So they think, how can we turn this into 4 or 5 pictures in some way or some.
It's disgusting. It is disgusting. Yeah. It's disgusting. There's nothing going on in Hollywood except for what they're putting out there for China and all the kids. There's nothing for anybody above 30.
I just did a movie for Beijing.
Really?
Actually, and the actors came over from Beijing, and they had 3 English-speaking actors. The director spoke English, but everybody had a translator. Except for me, no one spoke English in the movie. I did. And then they're going to translate everything I do into Mandarin. But what they did is off camera, behind me and behind whoever the Chinese actor I was working with was, they would have a translator holding the script, and they would point at me when it was my time to talk. And then they had someone on the other side of me when I said my line in English that would point at them when it was their time to talk. So we had no idea what we were saying to one another. But still, at the end of the scene, you know, the director goes, great scene. Fabulous.
So crazy. So listen to some of the films you've been attached to and some of the people you've played with. The Philadelphia Experiment, Nobody's Fool with Rosanna Arquette. And by the way, my friend, the late Gwen Wells, you worked with my friend Gwen.
Yeah.
Great lady. Really interesting girl. Mississippi Burning with my favorite, Gene Hackman, William Defoe, Frances McDormand. The favorite actor you've worked with? And I'm just naming a few. I mean, we'll go to more in a minute.
Favorite actor I've worked with on stage, I guess, would have to be Julie Haggerty. We did a show on Broadway for about 10 months, and then we came out to Los Angeles and did it at the Amundsen for another 3. And it was like breathing working with Julie. It was just wonderful. And in a film, probably one of the best actors. I've worked with so many really great, great actors. But Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, everybody thinks of Bill as a funny, wild, crazy guy. That he's not. He's not funny, wild, crazy guy in person, but when they roll the camera, he is such a wonderful actor. Every take, he's always listening. He's always being a part of the story. I loved working with Bill.
We're going to talk about that in a second. I want to go back to one thing that you said. You were actually nominated for a Tony as Best Featured Actor in a Play for your role in the film.
That's correct.
That's the show, the revival of Mornings at 7.
Yeah, for the people out there who don't know what it's like to get nominated for a major award, this is kind of the quick rundown. At about 7 a.m. Eastern Time, you get phone calls from business people that you've never talked to in your life. And they congratulate you on your nomination from lawyers, from stock accountants, you know, people who do your taxes. Stephen, congratulations on that nomination. And you go, well, oh, sure, sure. Because you figure they're looking to do business with you. Then you get the call from your agent congratulating you. Then you call your parents. And I called mom and dad. And dad says, well, do you have any chance of winning? I don't see how you could win. Then you're stuck in this position of you are nominated and you have to come up with an acceptance speech. And you're on this kind of cosmic slippery slope that you feel the more you work on your acceptance speech, the more likely you are to lose. So then you don't work on your acceptance speech. And then you think now you're going to win, but you're going to look like a fool up there when you're doing it. So then for the next month and a half, 2 months, you are working and not working on an acceptance speech in your head. I'm walking to and from the theater through Central Park talking to myself, and I'm looking around at all the people walking through the park, and they're talking to themselves too. And I realize we're all kind of working on that acceptance speech back and forth. I ended up not winning the award and locking myself out of my apartment on the same night. So I had to stay on the streets of New York in my tuxedo until we could break into my apartment at 10 o'clock the next day.
Ain't life grand.
Yeah, and let me tell you, when you're in New York City at 9 in the morning in a tuxedo,
yeah, they're looking
at you. That says one thing. You've been drinking all night.
And maybe some other things as well. Let me just name a couple of other of the films. I mean, so that everybody understands Basic Instinct with Sharon Stone, Bird on a Wire, Goldie Hawn, Mel Gibson, Groundhog Day, you already said, Thelma and Louise. Look for him. When you see the face, now you know the voice. You guys are going to freak out into how many great moments he's had in our film world. Television, where do we start? So let's start here. You turned down the role of Al in Home Improvement. What, huh? What?
Well,
is that true?
We see all of these things through the lens of looking backwards in time. But as Einstein will tell you, here on Earth, we can only move forward in time. And when I was offered that role, this was the deal. They were offering me the princely sum of $16,000 a show, which was a lot of money for me. Believe me, it was a lot of money. But my wife was pregnant with our first child, and they said that they had an exclusive contract on me so I could do no other work. I could only do that show. Now, they weren't sure if Home Improvements was going to start in January after the Super Bowl or if it was going to wait until the following September. 9 months later. Now, I could not work for 9-10 months waiting for this show to come, not knowing if it was going to be a success or failure or whatever, and turning down all other work. So I said, you have to let me at least do other work until you decide if you're going to do Home Improvements in a month or in 10 months. And they said, no, we're not going to do it. And I said, well, then I can't do the part.
Wow.
And so I turned it down. And then they called back and said, okay, we'll let you do one show. We'll let you do one movie. And I believe I was doing A Single White Female at the time. They said, you could do one other movie before then. And I said, I'm sorry, guys. I would love to do this show. I think it would be wonderful to do the show, but I have a baby on the way. I have a house mortgage, and you're only paying me $16,000 a show. And if those shows don't start for 10 months, I'm not going to be able to stay in my house. So, yes, I turned it down. And everybody, they did that, what is it, biography, true Hollywood story? You know, on TV about me turning down the true Home Improvement story. And they never told this part of the story. And I ran into the producer of the true Hollywood story at the gym. And I said, you know, you could have called me up and get my part of the true Hollywood story. Because that is a true Hollywood story, is that I had to turn down this show because you guys would not let me work on anything else for up to 10 months with a baby on the way for the princely sum of only $16,000, which was all they were guaranteeing me. They weren't guaranteeing me any more shows until they saw if it was going to be a success. So yes, Hallie, I ended up turning down several million
dollars. But you know what? It seems to have worked out in its own way pretty well, right?
I ended up doing Groundhog Day instead. I could have ended up being Al for years and making millions of dollars, or I could have done Groundhog Day and all the movies and other shows I've done. Now, I worked with Tim Allen later on Wild Hogs, and it was interesting because on the true Hollywood story, Tim was kind of dissing me of going like, who is this Tobolowsky guy that he's turning down Home Improvement? You know, some comic who's turning, well, first of all, I was never a comic, but this comic who's turning down this show, you know, screw him. Anyway, I worked with Tim on Wild Hogs, and I don't think he remembered that I was the same guy who turned down Al. And let me tell you something. Tim Allen is one of the most brilliant people I have ever met in my life. Now, I didn't get to do many scenes with Tim, but I got to witness him from afar. And that movie, Wild Hogs, good, bad, whatever you want to call it, would not have existed if it weren't for the brilliance of Tim Allen, because that show got greenlighted before they had a script, because they got all four guys. You know, they got John Travolta and, you know, and Martin Lawrence. You know, they got all the guys together, and Bill Macy. They got everybody and they said, let's shoot. And it was Tim with his improvisational ability that stitched those scenes together and made it seem like a movie. He's one of the most well-read people I've ever met. He knows history backwards and forwards. He knows English literature backwards and forwards. I mean, this guy is an amazing, amazing person. So I was glad I met him the way I did meet him.
It always works out the way it's supposed to anyway. I always believe that. Listen, let's have a Zelig moment. You also sing. You were the lead singer in the first band formed by guitar legend Stevie Ray Vaughan. I love this. You went to school together in Dallas. I'm telling you, you're Zelig. You show up at the right place at the right time.
Yes, I did sing, but the real singer of that group was someone named Bobby Forman, who really sang. In fact, Bobby had a career in the New Christy Minstrels after us.
Oh, man.
And in our little group, we had a three-man kind of folk rock group. We were really terrible, but we were picked to be one of the five Dallas area bands to do two songs on an album of Dallas bands called A New High, H-I. Now, this this was to indicate that somewhere in America, people smoked marijuana. Now, I don't think this was in Dallas at the time, because you could go to Segaville Prison in Dallas for possession of a joint, that's for sure. But we went to the recording studio, and on the way, Bobby said he asked a kid from our neighborhood, Stevie Vaughn, to play lead guitar on our songs with us for the recording. I said, you asked the kid from our, who's Stevie Vaughn? He says, well, he's a 14-year-old kid. And our 14-year-old kid? I go, Bobby, what are you talking about? We could play our own songs. We play our own guitars. And Bobby turned around and says, Stephen, shut up. Listen, this kid, Stevie Vaughn, can really play the guitar, and he's going to make us sound like we know what we're doing. And so we arrived at the recording studio, and there was Stevie sitting on his metal folding chair with his, I believe he had a Gibson at that time, with two of those humbucking pickups. And he said, so what are you guys doing? Want to play a little bit so I know what to do? So we played about 8 seconds of our first song. He says, okay, just stop. Okay. I know what I'm going to do. And we laid down our instrumental tracks in one take, and then we did a second, and that was it back then. That's all you got. And then the engineer said, okay, son, you want to do a lead? And Stevie got up and said, well, sure. He says, you know, this is kind of a crappy song that they're doing. So what if I did like a really bad lead and then switched to a really good lead? How about that? And they said, well, sure, son, you could do that. He goes, oh, yeah, I could do that. So Stevie played this lead and our jaws just dropped to the ground. The engineer said, oh, that was good, son. You got another one in you? And Stevie said, oh, yeah. He got up and then did one of these blistering Eric Clapton leads. Fabulous. And then I could see, like the fly on the wall, I saw the engineer go out the back door of the studio and call down the hallway, and other grown-ups come in. And look, he says, son, want to do another lead? I go, sure. Stevie got up, started laughing, playing another one of those leads where he hits those low bass notes, jump up to the real high notes, just fingers flying over that fretboard. And I'm looking through the window, and I see about 8 adult faces, all of them looking in awe. I'm looking at the guy who brought us in to record, again, eyes just staring straight ahead. And I realize this was the first time any of us saw the real thing. And by real thing, I mean real genius. We felt we were in the presence of something holy, separate from anything we had experienced in our lives. That was the only time I ever played with Stevie. That was the only time, that one time.
But still, isn't that fun to have that in your repertoire of events in your life? I think that is so cool. Listen to me. I have to take a break here.
Yep.
Before we go to break, though, I want to just say this. The Tobolowsky files. You, my friend, are a born storyteller, as my audience has just heard. You guys have got to go and listen to this phenomenal podcast he's making. He makes me jealous when I listen to his podcast. He'll tell us the story of that and how that came to be, maybe after the break if we have time. So, Stephen, just sit back for a second. We're going to break. We got to recognize the sponsors. And everybody in the audience, you do it the same. Relax for a minute, and we will be right back on the Hallie Kasser Jane Show.
Is someone you love living with frequent pain? Are they spending more time just sitting in a chair or lying in bed or going to the ER more often? Other than taking them to the doctor, you may not know what else to do. Treasure Coast Hospice can help in more ways than you may realize. Even if you don't think your loved one is ready for hospice care, their experts can evaluate your loved one's condition and direct you to the right resources in our community. Call Treasure Coast Hospice to learn more or visit tchospice.org.
Hello, I'm Hallie Kasser Jane, host of the Hallie Kasser Jane Show. Join me Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern when I talk with the great artists, writers, musicians, politicians, and celebrities of our day. The Hallie Kasser Jane Show is talk radio for fine minds. Tune in live or listen to the podcast at HallieKasserJane.com. We are back on the Helly Kester Jane Show. Today I'm talking with actor, writer, producer, podcaster, singer, father, husband, storyteller, Stephen Tobolowsky. Welcome back to the show. Stephen, nice to have you here. You're
Thank
a trip.
You. So nice to be here.
I mean, you were so cool. You were just wonderful to talk to. So listen to me. If you could come back in life as a leading man, who would that be?
It would be Stephen Tobolowsky with hair.
Well, you can do that. You can get one of those, you know, rags.
No,
they don't work, huh?
It doesn't work.
You're not
it
going there. Work. Okay. Well, so much for that. So switching gears, you come from a literary tradition, and I understand that your aunt was the head librarian at Ben Junior High School in Dallas, now Hillcrest High School. I want to say that for all of my friends in Dallas. So writing, The Dangerous Animal Club, as I said in the beginning, do you ever sleep? I don't think so, because you're writing, you're acting. Talk to me about this wonderful collection of stories you tell in this book. I love this book.
The thing about sleep when you write, I realized the difference between acting and writing. When you act, you finish, the curtain comes down, you go out with your friends, you have a cheeseburger and you go home. When you write, you never stop. It goes through your head. It goes through your dreams. You hear the different characters talking to you on. It never, never stops. It's maddening. The origin kind of the Dangerous Animals Club book. And these are all true stories from my life, some about showbiz, mostly not about showbiz, because I think actors telling show business stories is kind of like a shallow grave. Everybody thinks like, well, that's going to be interesting. Let's hear what happened on the set. But it's not that interesting unless there's a universal element to it. It was about, oh, gosh, what, 5 years ago? Maybe 6 years ago, I was in Iceland riding a horse on the side of an active volcano. Right. What could possibly go wrong? So anyway, it was terrible. We were hit by a freak windstorm, which Iceland is famous for, and it lifted me and the horse off the ground. No exaggeration there. I was there with other people. And the wind, like tornadic. The wind threw us down on the other side of the road, and the horse took off with me dangling off of the saddle. And somewhere on the other side of the mountain, I was thrown onto a hardened lava flow where apparently I sustained what later doctors called a fatal injury. I didn't know it at the time. I was going in and out of consciousness, but I broke five of my vertebra, and the fourth vertebra, C4, was crushed. So I had the Chris Reeve injury bad, and I had no idea. No one had any idea at this time about how bad it was, and I was mostly unconscious. I was there with Tony Shalhoub and Brooke Adams. They were on the horseback riding trip, too. And Brooke's sister, was in a terrible accident on horseback in Africa that was almost the same, not on a volcano, but I looked the same as her sister, and it was Brooke that insisted that they get me to a hospital. And I do believe to this day that it was Brooke that saved my life.
Wow.
They got me to Reykjavik, and they put me in a brace. I was walking around Iceland for a few days, flew back to America, and that's when I saw my doctor, who told me I had a fatal injury, and asked if I wanted to know why I was alive. And I said, uh-huh, because I was in one of those big braces now. And he said, you're alive because you had advanced arthritis of the neck, which I found very depressing. You know, but I had advanced arthritis of the neck and the bone on bone and the fact that the vertebra had like overgrown one another and that my neck was warped and twisted made it to where the blow went out into my shoulders instead of snapping my neck off. So I was alive because of a curse, this advanced arthritis. And when you have a broken neck, there isn't a lot you can do. I couldn't act. I couldn't audition. I could walk, but I couldn't walk much. So one of the things I could do to keep my spirits alive was I had this notion, what if what the doctor said was true? And what if this was a fatal injury and I was never able to see my wife or children again? I said, what if I wrote the stories of my life so that my children would know who their father was in case I ever get stupid enough to ride a horse again. You know, so the Dangerous Animals Club were the stories I would tell my children to say, if you want to know your dad, read this book. This is the testament of who your dad was in life. And so it has stories of me hunting snakes when I was a child and teacher trying to throw me out of college later on and some show business stories of crazy things that happened.
It's a great, great, hear me, great read. It is just fabulous. And I actually have it by my bed and I'm like, I'm going to sleep with you every night lately,
oh, that's good.
Reading, you know, chapter by chapter, because each of them is their own individual story. Everybody picked this unbelievable book up. Stephen, you talked about that. That's not the only crazy thing that's happened to you in your life. You're like an accident waiting to happen. Seriously, you were once held hostage at gunpoint in a supermarket in Snyder Plaza, yes. Dallas. You were almost murdered twice in 1 week in Hartford, Connecticut by different people. I mean,
yes. Well, we were in a rough neighborhood. I'm sure if I stayed longer, it would have been more. Yeah, but twice they were going to have me on Tom Snyder before.
Oh, God, Tom, I love Snyder, Tom Snyder. Yeah.
Tomorrow show. Right?
Yeah,
tomorrow.
The late.
And they said,
late,
can you write out a list of 10 things that you've done that are weird? And so I'm writing out this list. And I was almost killed like on a... like a Monday and a Wednesday or Tuesday and Thursday in Hartford, Connecticut. I mean, that's tough. And held hostage at gunpoint in a grocery store. Yeah, a guy came up to me and just pulled a gun out and stuck it in my forehead and said, I don't know why I picked you today. I don't know why. And the first thing I thought of was Chad Everett. You know, you can't make stuff like that up. It's like I thought of Chad Everett on Medical Center, and he had a show on Medical Center, which was very popular at the time, about what to do in a hostage situation. And Chad Everett said you had to keep the hostage, you have to keep him talking. You have to keep the guy with the gun talking. Well, I didn't know how to do that, but I knew how to talk. So I talked to this guy. I didn't even take a breath that I was talking so fast about my life and career and how I was disappointing my father and how he reminded me of my father. And maybe if there was just some way the two people could sit at it, you know, blah, 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 blah. But for some reason, the nonstop jabber was enough noise for the SWAT team to come in the back of the store and go on adjacent aisles. And, you know, scarier than the moment where the guy stuck the gun in my head was when I ran out of gas after about 45 minutes of nonstop talking, and a voice came in my ear and said, Stephen, you gotta do something different now. Gotta do something different. And the only thing I could think to do was to invite the guy over for dinner. And so he's got the gun in my head, and I'm saying, you know, I have to go get this chicken on. I don't know if you're doing anything later tonight, but why don't you come on over? And I'm getting a lot out of this. I mean, I'm working a lot of problems out with my dad, and I don't know if you're getting anything, but come on over. You can meet my girlfriend, Beth. We'll cook up the chicken and have some mangoes and wine. We'll just keep this party going. And I push past him with the shopping cart. Oh, God, it was like in slow motion. I still see it now. And I felt the gun go into the back of my head. And the little voice came back in my ear and said, don't turn around. Don't turn around. Whatever you do, don't turn around. Get to the end of the aisle. And if you get there, you could run. If you get there, you could run. And I got to the end of the aisle, and I turned my cart, and I didn't have to run because that SWAT team took that distance I had given them, and they jumped over the food. And next time you are in a grocery store, ladies and gentlemen, look and see how high those shelves are. That SWAT team jumped over the food and had my potential dinner guest bound and gagged. I'm saying, I mean, it was like 8 seconds. And I'm wandering in this deserted store alone. They're carrying this guy out like a carpet on their shoulders, like a boa constrictor. He's just squiggling. They carry him out, put him in the police car. I'm wandering in the completely deserted store with my groceries, and I go up to a deserted checkout stand and wait. Policeman came up to me and patted me on the back and said, hey, pal, you could just go. I go, oh, thanks. So I got my groceries and went home, and my girlfriend Beth was there and said, well, where were you? I said, well, I was just held hostage at gunpoint. And she said, well, it took a long time. I said, I know the hostage thing takes a lot longer than you would think it would take. You know, I'm starving. And I still look back at that moment, and the one thing that really comes back at me, it's the one time that I ever left a store without paying for my groceries. Free.
Stephen, more than anybody I have ever interviewed, and I don't have to tell you how many people I have interviewed, you are, without a question, without a doubt, the only person I know who is a true character in his own life.
Well, I guess that's what, you know, that's kind of where the podcast came
exactly.
from. Exactly. I did this movie, a friend of mine, Robert Brinkman, who is a wonderful cinematographer, did Encino Man, Cable Guy, all sorts of great shows. He said, you know, I love your story, Stephen. What if we set up a camera and you just tell your stories to the camera? Well, with the advent of HD, that movie was able to be made because it was cheap enough, and we premiered it at the HBO Comedy Festival in Aspen. Now it's been all over the world. Stephen Tobolowsky's birthday party.
Listen, you just took my thunder. I was going to say that you actually invited me to your birthday party by sending me the DVD. The best I'll ever get to your birthday party. That is so wonderful. Can I tell you? I was so engaged in that. That is a true piece of art. Okay, you take it over.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, I love that movie. I love that movie too.
Yeah.
And it's right now it's been all over the world. We played at the London Film Festival and we opened the Bologna Film Festival. It's been everywhere.
It's fabulous.
This student from Harvard at the time named David Chen saw that movie and he had a movie podcast on the internet called slashfilm.com where he reviewed movies. And he loved Birthday Party and wanted to talk to me. This is back when I had the broken neck. So I'm sitting at home and I get a call from this guy who I don't know. And he says, how would you like to continue what you did with Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday Party? Tell true stories about your life, but we'll do them as a podcast. And I'll produce it. I'll record it. You do whatever you want. And so I thought, you know, on the internet, it's filled with people just winging it. And I said, well, David, I have a lot of time on my hands now. And I'm thinking of Dangerous Animals Club about writing these. I'm thinking about writing these stories anyway. Let me write. I will write these stories down. And so now these stories have been, of course, with the internet, they've been all over the world. They've been on national radio. And we just put out episode 68 this last week. So that's 68 hours of the Tobolowsky Files, which is free, totally free. And you know, let me tell you, good things come to you when you do it for free, too, because I was invited to Dublin to do some of my stories. I was invited to Auckland to do some
of my
stories.
Yeah.
So it's been fun doing this. And yeah, it's interesting when you become a character in your podcast, because once you tell the story, it changes. It changes you by the fact that it's no longer in your head, by the fact that you've concretized and committed to writing the story. It somehow is no longer just yours. So I have mixed feelings about all that.
Well, I can understand that. But it's such a gift to the world to give it because the stories are that wonderful and that informative in that you take what I every time I listen to one of your stories, I just take it and bring it back to my own life. It opens up so many processes in my brain. Yeah. I want to talk about Californication.
Ah.
I want to talk about Stu Biggs.
Yeah.
Okay. What was it like to get naked and fake fornicate and stuff? And stuff with the talented Pamela Adlon. Let me take this out one step. You know, I was watching Dakota Johnson and Jamie Dornan the other day talk about their sex scenes in 50 Shades of Grey. You know, I was thinking about you walking around buck-ass naked and you guys doing the little shtick that you were doing. And, you know, they said, oh, you know, it's all so technical, you know, and there are only a few people there, but it's, you know, we count how we breathe. We count how we, what a crock of, you tell me you don't get turned on when you're, I mean, I don't believe you can't get turned on when you're playing those scenes. Come on, talk to me. Your wife's not listening.
You cannot get turned on doing those things. Let me give you an example. Now, who in Californication, I had a love scene with Pam. Now, let me tell you also, it depends who your partner is. Like Pam Adlon, I would have fake fornication with Pam Adlon any day of the week. She is the best fake lover in the world. She is hysterical. She's a wonderful person. And it takes a good partner, just like real sex. You have to sign a rider with the Screen Actors Guild, a 4-page simulated sex rider that says no part of you will enter any part of Pam Adlon. And there will always be a barrier in between you and any part of Pam. So for this particular sex scene, the barrier was a Stay Freed maxi pad. And I had my face buried in a Stay Free maxi pad for 5 hours as they shot the scene from different angles. Now, that takes a professional actor. I know there's some young people out there who want to go into acting. That takes a professional.
All that training, darling.
They asked me how large of a penis I wanted on the show. Now, where do you get ask that question. And so the guy who was asking me this is a specialist. He says that he has stuffed the crotches of some of the biggest people in Hollywood. Well, if he's stuffing the crotches, they're obviously not the biggest people in Hollywood. But anyway, so he has this array of sexual appendages to stick in my pants to pretend to be me. And he says, you know, you just pick whatever one you want. Well, obviously, as a guy, you pick the biggest one first.
Oh, of course.
But then they have no pants that could fit around that. And so you end up, we ended up with two pairs of rolled up tube socks and a drinking glass kind of rolled together, stuffed into my shorts. Now, one time, no, this is true. And this is awful. This is a horrible story.
Oh, great. I can't wait.
You love those. It's different when you're on stage.
Oh.
I had to do a scene where I was making out with a girl on stage. And we were in this play. It was a hit play, crazy play called No Scratch. And I was making out with Joan Perkle for several months. We were running at the Odyssey Theater in Los Angeles. And Joan is a wonderful actress, great sense of humor. Indeed, you always need a great sense of humor when you're making out with them constantly. I did get, what's the technical word? I did get aroused one night during this show. And I was wearing kind of those drawstring cargo pants, which meant I could not stand up. You know? And I had to stand up and do a monologue. I had to get up soon and do a monologue. So Joni is kissing me, and I'm whispering to her, I'm saying, stop. You have to stop now. This can't go on any further. And she looked down, and she saw that little Steve was in action. And she started laughing hysterically. And I said, stop laughing. You know, we have to. But actually, you know, the laughter could have helped. As it turned out, now this is kind of an interesting sidebar to this story. This was a futuristic play. It took place in the future where everybody is wearing like chainmail and bits and pieces of football uniforms and all sorts of stuff. And there's constant war going on. And it takes place in a theater where they do a play with no script for 24 hours constantly. And the actors live on stage. As it turned out, the designer for a film that was going to be called Mad Max was in the audience watching our play before the Mad Max trilogy came out. And our design from our play was in the Mad Max trilogy.
Wow, that's
cool. Of the people wearing the chain mail and all that stuff. So as a policeman, I'm wearing like these kind of drawstring cargo pants and chainmail. So I had to get up to do that speech. And so while Joan was laughing, I pushed the chainmail down as hard as I could, creating enormous amount of pain.
Ouch.
And I still did the speech seated with my legs crossed, but it did teach me an important lesson, which is never get involved with people you're working with. It just...
not a good idea.
Not a good idea.
Not a
good idea. Even on stage, you just got to pretend. You can't get emotionally involved.
So I want to talk to you. First of all, you've got a recurring role right now on the Goldbergs as Principal Ball. You're working with one of my favorite people in the whole world, George Segal. Wonderful guy.
Haven't done a scene with him
I
yet,
know you haven't, but
one of my favorite actors in the world, too.
You should, he's a great guy. I used to play with him years ago in Hollywood. Okay, so that's just the great thing. But you've got something huge coming, big time in Hollywood, Florida.
I'm in Hollywood, Florida.
Ben Stiller. Oh, my God. He's executive producer. Comedy Central. Let me get it out. March 4th. Talk to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was remarkable. These two young guys, Alex Anfanger and Dan Schimpf. Remember those names, everybody, because you will. You will. These guys, this is the new paradigm. This is where entertainment is. These two young guys did a, what do you call it, a webisode? Mm-hmm. One of these things that you film and you put on the internet. Like, no big deal. But it was so funny and so unique and so skillfully put together by these two guys. New York Times wrote an article about them. Ben Stiller saw the show and said, we got to work with these guys. And so Ben Stiller was our executive producer, took Alex and Dan to Comedy Central, and they crafted this show big time in Hollywood, Florida. And it is one of the most delightful casts. I thought I would never be on a show again as fun to work on as Californication. But big time in Hollywood, Florida was so fun. and so funny. And we have Cuba Gooding Jr. and we have Michael Metz and we have Jason Alexander. We have so many great. Kathy Baker plays my wife. A great, funny, funny show. And I haven't seen any of it except for when I looped. And when I looped and saw my stuff and other people's stuff, it was funny. But what I saw was the surprise in Ben Stiller's eyes. He came up to me when we did one of those panels where we talked to film critics and stuff about the show. And you expect people who are involved in the show to do the old, hello, how are you, glad hand. Oh, man, the show's fabulous. You're wonderful. Oh, we love it. You expect that. But what you don't expect is the surprise. And Ben looked at me and said, like, Stephen, it's really hilarious. It really is funny. It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And when Ben Stiller is saying that, it means something. The last time somebody hit me with that surprise was Ridley Scott. We had finished shooting Thelma and Louise. I'm walking down Wilshire Boulevard, and Ridley comes out of some building there, and he says, Stephen, I just put the movie together, and it's good. I think it really is good. And it was the surprise that sold me. And I think big time in Hollywood, Florida. When does it premiere? March 4th.
Comedy Central. Can't wait.
It's going to be hilarious, I think.
I'm sure. I'm sure.
Well, it's if the hilarity that we were experiencing on the set is captured by the film, then it's going to be amazing. And Ben said that's one of the things that makes it work, is that the kind of feeling of fellow feeling among the cast.
Oh, yeah. Translates. When you have, yeah, that does. When everybody loves each other and everybody gets along, sure. That always makes for, you were on Seinfeld. You know, that Seinfeld was the best of that. I mean, you could see how everybody was. Listen, you also have the Primary Instinct.
Yeah, boy. Again, it's the new paradigm. Well, David Chen said, how would you feel about doing a Kickstarter movie? Kickstarters are like relationships for people out there. You never ask for what you need. You only ask for what you think you can get. Because if you fall short of your Kickstarter goal, you get nothing. So we asked for $40,000. We were lucky we got $50,000. And we did a movie of me doing a concert event in Seattle of my stories. We only had the time and money and the camera crew to do one show. So we have one show, we have seven cameras, we have a sound crew, and the show, it couldn't have gone any better. And it was delightful. We had 1,000 people show up for this thing. It was filmed, and the movie is terrific. And it's, again, true stories kind of from my life kind of woven together. And right now, the film has been locked, which means that it's completed and it's been sent out to the film festivals. And we have 2 or 3 film festivals that have already asked us to show it. And it's a miracle that it even got made. But it is delightful. It is a very sweet movie, and I love it a lot. A lot like Birthday Party, except it's one long story as opposed to 30 short stories.
Okay, The Primary Instinct. So everybody look for that. I also wanted, before we close, I want to bring this. You've been married for 27 years? Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. that's just in Hollywood, no less. Oh, my God.
In Hollywood. Let me tell you, and we've only tried to get divorced 3 times.
Well, hey, that's not bad. You know, that's not bad at all. I mean, all things considered, you deserve an Emmy, by the way, for that achievement. Who does that? Not for the 2 sons you guys produce, by the way, because, you know, but for the long marriage in Hollywood. So really, despite everything, despite all the craziness and all the quirks, Stephen, you're a mensch. You're a quirky mensch.
I love that girl. Let me tell you, I love that girl. And, you know, she's saved my life 3 times.
Wow.
And you know how a dog is when you save its life.
Mm-hmm.
So multiply that by 3. And this dog is that grateful.
Boy, are you lucky.
I love her to death. And, you know, you learn a lot. If you stay married for 27 years, you either get divorced or you learn a lot. And we learned a lot. And we love each other dearly.
Well,
dearly.
I'll tell you, she's a lucky girl. I think, so this is what I'm going to say to you as we say, like, you know, sayonara or whatever it is. You know, you've earned that Davy Crockett coonskin cap.
I've been speaking with Stephen Tobolowsky, currently appearing on ABC's The Goldbergs and soon to be seen in Comedy Central's hilarious new show, executive produced by Ben Stiller, big time in Hollywood, Florida. Be sure to pick up his book, Dangerous Animal Club, by way of Simon & Schuster, and visit his website, stephentobolowsky.wordpress.com. For a look at everything he's doing. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. Oh, and while you're at HallieKasserJane.com, don't forget to visit my blog to read my latest musings. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieKasserJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.